The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. In this broadcast, I'm going to take a look at some aspects of the Second World War and how so much of what we hear about that terrible conflict in our movies, our schools, and on television is distorted. But first, I'll be talking about a prominent personality of wartime Germany. What I'll be saying about Joseph Goebbels, one of the most interesting leaders of the Third Reich, is based on an address I gave a few weeks ago at a meeting here in Orange County, Southern California. That meeting, at which British historian David Irving also spoke, was a success in spite of efforts by local bigots to disrupt it. A full report on that meeting, including details about the campaign by bigoted activists to disrupt it, is posted on the homepage of the IHR website, ihr.org. Also posted on the website homepage is the text of my talk at that meeting, an address entitled Goebbels and World War II Propaganda. Apart from Hitler himself, perhaps the most fascinating figure of Third Reich Germany is the regime's chief publicist and spokesman, Joseph Goebbels. He is widely portrayed as a master of lies and deceitful propaganda, but this familiar image, which is particularly entrenched here in the United States, is itself a propaganda falsehood. Goebbels was raised in a middle-class Roman Catholic family in a medium-sized city in the German Rhineland. He had a first-rate education and was an outstanding student. At the age of 24, he earned a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Heidelberg. After an unsuccessful effort to find employment as a writer for major national daily papers and a nine-month stint working at a bank in Cologne, he became an activist in the fledgling National Socialist Party. In 1926, at the age of 29, Hitler appointed him party district leader, or Gauleiter, of Berlin. He lost no time taking firm control of the small and feuding party organization in the nation's most important city, and infusing it with new dynamism. He quickly proved himself a quick-witted and sharp-tongued public speaker, and a courageous, skilled, and creative organizer. In early 1933, 6 weeks after Hitler became chancellor, the 35-year-old Goebbels was named Reich Minister for Propaganda and Popular Enlightenment. In this newly created position, and then as president of the Reich Culture Chamber, he exercised wide control over Germany's new newspapers, radio broadcasting, motion pictures, magazine, and book publishing. More than anyone else, he set the parameters and tone of the nation's mass media and cultural life. During the first years of the Second World War, September 1939 to December 1942, his job was relatively easy. With an almost unbroken string of German and Axis military victories, maintaining public morale was not difficult. His greatest challenge came during the final 2 years of the war, as Germany's armies suffered ever more terrible military reverses, and as her great cities were battered into ruins under a growing storm of murderous British-American bombing. It was during this period, as utter defeat loomed, that Goebbels most strikingly proved his skill as a master molder of public opinion. In spite of the drastically worsening situation, both on the front lines and at home, he largely succeeded in maintaining public morale, confidence in Hitler's leadership, and even hope. One of the best profiles of this man is the biography by German historian Helmut Heiber. Although his portrayal is highly critical and generally unflattering, the author nonetheless acknowledges his subject's extraordinary talents and abilities. Goebbels, he writes, was able until the very last minute to encourage and exploit a blind trust in Hitler and his genius. It is indeed one of the macabre phenomena of the Third Reich that even in their country's agony, the mass of the German people remained docile and faithful to Hitler's banner. In spite of everything they had experienced, they kept the faith. After the great defeat at Stalingrad in early 1943, Goebbels was the first official forthrightly to acknowledge the gravity of the peril that faced the nation in Europe, and frankly to concede that Germany could lose the war. His frankness and even courage during these increasingly difficult months won him a measure of popular admiration. Historian Heiber writes, quote, "As other influential Nazis began to creep into their shells, Goebbels could dare to appear before a mob and not only gain a hearing, but even arouse faith and hope." As the war dragged on, Goebbels' front page editorial essays in the weekly paper Das Reich played an increasingly important role in sustaining public morale. They were widely reprinted and routinely read over the radio. Heiber writes, "Goebbels' articles in Das Reich were indeed excellent, brilliantly written, and full of bright ideas. Goebbels' articles were carefully worked out more than a week before they were to appear, written in excellent, polished German, stylistically enjoyable, and relatively discriminating in content. Often they seemed illumined by the lofty wisdom of a great thinker. Their very titles were reminiscent of philosophical treatises on the meaning of war, the essential nature of the crisis, on the work of the spirit, on speaking and being silent, the indispensability of freedom, about national duty in war. It is all very well turned and very solid. These articles made an impression and Goebbels knew it." Unquote. During this period, Goebbels also directed German newspapers, magazines, and newsreels to stress the themes of continental unity and a common European destiny, and the goal of building a peaceful and prosperous community of nations. Now, one notable exception to this theme was a kind of official silence regarding Poland and the Poles, and of course, the German media was vehemently anti-Jewish. In keeping with the outlook of Germany's wartime leadership, Goebbels instructed the German press, radio, and newsreels to portray other nations and ethnic groups tactfully and with regard for the sovereignty and national character of other peoples. He stressed the importance of treating other nations and peoples with tact and respect. This outlook was laid out in confidential guidelines to the German media. In February 1943, Goebbels issued an internal directive in which he ordered, and I'm quoting here, "The entire propaganda work of the National Socialist Party and the German National Socialist State must accordingly be organized to make clear, not just to the German nation, but also to the other European peoples, including the peoples in the occupied Eastern territories and in the countries still under Soviet Bolshevik rule, that the victory of Adolf Hitler and of German arms is in their own most basic self-interest. It is therefore inappropriate to hurt the feelings of inner self-worth of these peoples, directly or indirectly, especially those of the Eastern nationalities, particularly in public speeches or writings. Stalin and the Bolshevik system should be attacked as bestial, but not the peoples who have been subdued by them. Similarly inappropriate is any discussion of the future new order of Europe that might create the impression among peoples of foreign nationality that the German leadership intends to maintain any long-term relationship of subjugation. Completely out of place are any remarks suggesting that Germany might set up colonies in the East or carry out a colonial policy or treat the land or its inhabitants as objects of exploitation. Following their systematic destruction by the Bolsheviks, that is, in accord with Stalin's scorched earth order of July 1941, the occupied eastern territories will be rebuilt under German leadership. With the riches of the soil, this will secure, for the long-term future, freedom in food and raw materials, as well as the social advancement for Germany and all of Europe, and thereby also for the peoples living in the East. Unquote. A few weeks later, in mid-March 1943, Goebbels reinforced these guiding principles in a talk to foreign journalists about the new Europe. He said, quote, "The severe measures that Germany has been forced by the war situation to introduce in the occupied eastern territories are valid only for the duration of the war. The new Europe will be held together not by compulsion, but rather it will be built on the basis of free will. There will be no dictatorship over the various nations of Europe, including individual national identity will not be extinguished. No European country will be obliged to introduce any particular social political system. If countries want to hold on to their traditional democracy, that's their own business." Unquote. One of the most emotionally moving and enduring chapters of the Second World War is the mass killing at Katyn and other places in April 1940 by Soviet secret police of some 14,000 Polish officers and Polish intellectuals who had been captured and rounded up when Eastern Poland was invaded and occupied by the Soviets half a year earlier. For decades, this has been an especially painful subject for the Polish people, because this was the annihilation not merely of thousands of fellow Poles, but of a significant portion of the nation's intellectual, political, and military leadership. This grim story is movingly dramatized, for example, in the 2007 Polish feature film titled Katyn. In April 1943, Germany announced to the world that a mass grave of murdered Poles had been discovered in the Katyn forest near Smolensk in occupied Russia. Goebbels saw to it that this sensational news was prominently highlighted in the German media. In accord with his instructions, newspapers and magazines devoted great attention to this story, giving it weeks of detailed, often front-page coverage. In London, officials of the Polish government in exile took a keen interest in this discovery, because for several years, Soviet officials had refused to provide any information to Polish authorities about the fate of the thousands of Polish officers that the Soviets had taken prisoner in 1939, and of whom all trace had been lost since the spring of 1940. Shortly after the German announcement in April 1943, Polish officials in London asked the International Committee of the Red Cross in neutral Switzerland to investigate. The German authorities quickly agreed. This prompted the Soviet government to accuse the Poles of collusion with the Germans, and then to break relations with the Polish government in London. Goebbels traced the unfolding of this story in his diary. In the entry of April 14, 1943, he noted, quote, "We are now using the discovery of 12,000 Polish officers murdered by the GPU, the Soviet secret police, for anti-Bolshevik propaganda on a great scale. We sent neutral journalists and Polish intellectuals to the spot where they were found. I give instructions to make the widest possible use of this propaganda material. Well, in fact, the number of Poles killed was about 14,000, of whom some 4,500 were shot and buried at Katyn. Most, in fact, were killed by the Soviets at two other sites. 3 days later, Goebbels noted in his diary, quote, "The Katyn incident is developing into a gigantic political affair which may have wide repercussions. We are exploiting it in every manner possible." Then, in the diary entry of April 27th, he reports, "The Katyn incident has taken a really sensational turn through the fact that the Soviets have broken off diplomatic relations with the Poles, giving the attitude of the Polish government in exile, that is, with regard to the Katyn matter, as the reason." The next day, in the entry of April 28 of his diary, Goebbels remarked with some pride, quote, "The most important theme of all international discussion is, naturally, the break between Moscow and the Polish emigre government. All enemy broadcasts and newspapers agree that this break represents a 100% victory for German propaganda and especially for me personally." The commentators marvel at the extraordinary cleverness with which we have been able to convert the Katyn incident into a highly political question. One can speak of a complete triumph of German propaganda. Throughout this whole war, we have seldom been able to register such a success." Unquote. The next day, in the diary entry of April 29th, Goebbels noted, quote, "The Polish conflict still holds the center of the stage. Seldom since the beginning of the war has any affair stirred up so much public discussion as this. The Poles are given a brush off by the English and the Americans as if they were enemies. It is admitted that I succeeded in driving a deep wedge into the enemy." Well, the break in relations between the Soviet and Polish governments in 1943 was a major diplomatic and public relations setback for the Allied war effort. It made an embarrassing mockery of the goals proclaimed by the Allied leaders. It underscored the pretense and hypocrisy of the claims of the British, American, and Soviet governments that they were fighting for freedom and democracy. In his skillful and energetic treatment of the Katyn massacre story, Goebbels contributed significantly to a major Allied political defeat and thereby scored what was perhaps his greatest single wartime propaganda achievement. It's worth comparing how the Katyn massacre was dealt with in the German wartime media, which was under Goebbels' supervision, with how it was treated in the American media during this same period. Not only in Germany, but across Europe, the press and other media gave prominent and detailed attention to this story and to the break in relations between the Polish and Soviet governments that it triggered. In the United States, newspapers and magazines understandably gave much less attention to the Katyn affair, but they could not entirely ignore it, especially after it brought on an embarrassing break in the Allied coalition. The American media, acting in harmony with the views and interests of the U.S. government and of America's most important military ally, the Soviet Union, basically treated the Katyn matter as a German propaganda lie. The tone for how this was handled in the U.S. media was set by the Office of War Information, an official U.S. government propaganda agency. Its director, Elmer Davis, spoke about Katyn in a radio broadcast on May 3, 1943, in which he dismissed the German reports on this as a great propaganda hoax. American newspapers echoed this official view. Writing in the New York Times, foreign affairs commentator Ann O'Hara McCormick explained to readers of that influential daily that there was no proof that the officers had even been killed. William L. Shirer, a prominent American journalist who is perhaps better known for his best-selling but historically deceitful book, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, dismissed the Berlin reports on Katyn as, quote, German propaganda, unquote. The United Press, a major U.S. wire service news agency, dealt with the matter in a dispatch that appeared in many American newspapers. This UP item, which was typical of American press treatment of the matter, referred to what it called the alleged disappearance of the Polish officers, which, it went on, has been used by the Berlin radio for propaganda purposes. The Germans claim the men were killed. Another prominent American daily paper explained that the German reports about Katyn had been concocted with diabolical cunning. In the U.S. Capitol, the Washington Post told readers that the assumption of loyal members of the United Nations, that is, the alliance headed by the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union, must be that they, the Poles, were killed by the Germans. Now, while Germany's wartime media was not always entirely accurate or fair, it's important to realize that with regard, anyway, to this very important chapter of World War II, Goebbels and the German media told the truth, while American officials and the U.S. media told lies. In addition to his work as the nation's chief spokesman and propagandist, Goebbels took on ever greater organizational and policy-making responsibilities during the war, playing an increasingly important role in keeping the nation's industrial and social machinery functioning. In the summer of 1944, Hitler named him Reich Plenipotentiary for the total war mobilization. And thus, during the final catastrophic months of the war, Goebbels, along with Armaments Minister Albert Speer, directed Germany's human and material resources for maximum war production, while simultaneously seeing to the continued operation of the nation's electrical, power and water plants, transportation and telephone systems, food and fuel supply networks, public schools, radio broadcasting, and daily newspaper publishing. This organizational feat of keeping essential social and community services functioning, while at the same time maintaining and even sharply increasing armaments production, in spite of the devastating aerial bombardment and an ever-worsening military situation, is an achievement without historical parallel. His final radio broadcast to the nation over what remained of a tattered network was delivered on April 19, 1945, 12 days before his death. As he had done every year since 1933, Goebbels spoke to the nation on the eve of Hitler's birthday. Even on this occasion, when the terrible end was glaringly obvious to all, Goebbels spoke with eloquent, controlled passion, and while frankly acknowledging the supreme gravity of the situation, he was still able to persuade and inspire. Contrary to the propaganda image that millions have come to accept, Goebbels was successful as a publicist and spokesman not because he was a master of the big lie, but rather as a result of his regard for accuracy and truth. As biographer Helmut Heiber notes, quote, Goebbels was accordingly able to celebrate his information policy as being not only superior to the enemy's in its monolithic character, but also of a seriousness and credibility which simply cannot be surpassed. The boast could be made with some justification. Seen in the long view, Goebbels preached, the best propaganda is that which does no more than serve the truth. Goebbels's real lies, his conscious lies, always pertained to mere detail. Goebbels's lies were more in the nature of those equivocations and evasions by which government spokesmen everywhere seek to protect the, quote, national interest, unquote. The post-war image of Goebbels as a master dissembler is itself a propaganda distortion, explains French scholar Jacques Ellul in his classic study, Propaganda. He writes, there remains the problem of Goebbels's reputation. He wore the title of Big Liar bestowed by Anglo-Saxon propaganda, and yet he never stopped battling for propaganda to be as accurate as possible. Well, at this point, we're going to take a break, and I'll return in a few minutes with the second portion of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Privacy gone out the window in the United States? Is the country moving more towards a permanent police, permanent surveillance state? Joining me for more from Boston, Massachusetts is Aaron Schwartz, founder and executive director of Demand Progress. Thanks so much for being with us, Aaron. The Patriot Act. Today there was a hearing on reauthorization. This month it's up for renewal. The Obama administration pushes for it, says it's important for national security. Why not?
Well, I think we've seen a real reversal from the Obama administration. I mean, this was a guy who, during the campaign, talked repeatedly about how he wanted to repeal the excesses of the Bush administration, specifically the Patriot Act. Now, once he's in office, he's reversed his position and wants to continue it. And I think he should stick with his original promise.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up. I want to go ahead and play a little bit of sound, something that Obama said back when he was campaigning, when he was Senator Barack Obama, and he was doing exactly as you said. He said that the Patriot Act needed to be repealed, needed to end, and here was his criticism about that. Can we roll that?
You know, I taught constitutional law for 10 years. I take the Constitution very seriously. The biggest problems that we're facing right now have to do with George Bush trying to bring more and more power into the executive branch and not go through Congress at all. And that's what I intend to reverse when I'm president of the United States of America.
And oops, he signed into law extensions to the Patriot Act. So do you think that perhaps, you know, to play devil's advocate, this shows that he got into office and realized, hey, we really need this. This is fighting terror. This is important to our national security and therefore would justify extending it?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, they just had a huge national security success, the sort of extrajudicial killing of bin Laden, where they haven't been able to show a single example of how the Patriot Act was used to help that. And in fact, they've provided no evidence of the Patriot Act successfully being used to catch any terrorists. And most of its provisions instead are used for the sort of domestic people we saw in the clip earlier, people who are just trying to express political speech and engage in political activity. And instead, the Patriot Act gets abused to use against them. So I think what really happened is not he changed his mind based on the evidence, but, you know, he likes having it when he's in charge and not when someone else is in charge, which is why it's so important for people outside the executive branch to really keep the pressure on, which is why tens of thousands of people went to demandprogress.org and signed our petition to end the Patriot Act.
You got a little plug in there, but I want to go back to this. So if it is essential to national security, as the administration has said, and you know, you sitting in your chair just don't know it because it hasn't affected your life, would you be okay with ending the Patriot Act and having perhaps the national security affected, maybe having it affect you, maybe, you know, there's an attack that could have been stopped that isn't. Would you be okay with that in the name of feeling?
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about the reputation, especially here in the United States, of Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's wartime and Third Reich propaganda minister. As I mentioned, his reputation as a master of diabolical propaganda lies is itself a distortion of reality. It's a kind of propaganda victory for those who won World War II. The French scholar Jacques Ellul wrote in his outstanding study entitled Propaganda that In fact, Goebbels strove conscientiously for accuracy and truthfulness in public statements and in public relations. Elul wrote, quote, Goebbels was always the first to announce disastrous events or difficult situations without hiding anything. The result was a general belief between 1939 and 1942 that German communiques not only were more concise, clearer, and less cluttered, but were more truthful than Allied communiques. And furthermore, that the Germans published all the news 2 or 3 days before the Allies. All this is so true that pinning the title of big liar on Goebbels must be considered quite a propaganda success, unquote. Just days before his death in 1945, Goebbels wrote a letter to his stepson. It was a son named Harold, who was the son of his wife by a previous marriage. In this letter, Goebbels expressed confidence that truth would ultimately prevail. He wrote, "Do not let yourself be disconcerted by the worldwide clamor that will now begin. There will come a day when all the lies will collapse under their own weight, and truth will again triumph." Well, shifting in this broadcast to a somewhat related but different topic, I'm going to talk a little bit about World War II, about the U.S. military, and about the role of the military in the U.S. military in the world today. With regard to World War II, it plays a very important role in the American consciousness and the American national mythology because it was the one war in America's history that in our society and in our media and our motion pictures and so forth is presented as the good war, the war in which there was a clear contrast and conflict between the so-called good guys and the so-called bad guys. World War II is presented as a conflict in which the good Americans defeated the bad, evil Nazis. Now, all sorts of other aspects of World War II have been sort of swept under the rug in order to try to uphold this image of World War II as the good war in American history. Americans might have doubts and arguments and debate about the merits of the Vietnam War, about even the merits of World War I, about America's involvement in the Iraq War. It's widely conceded that the Iraq War was launched by President Bush on the basis of deceit and lies to the public. The Vietnam War was a fiasco and also carried out and launched on the basis of lies and deceit by President Johnson. But the image of World War II as the good war is still very much in place in America, in large measure because Hitler is portrayed as so evil, so bad, that any price should have been paid to rid the world of him. Supposedly, we're told over and over again, Hitler had to be stopped because he was trying to take over the world. He was a threat to the United States and a threat to everybody. And this was the theme of American propaganda even before the United States formally got involved in the war. Even in 1940 and 1941, when the United States was still nominally neutral, President Franklin Roosevelt and other high-ranking Washington White House officials and much of the American media presented Hitler as a leader bent on trying to take over the world. Now, the truth about this is known for people who care to study it, but it's still very difficult for people to widely accept it because it runs so counter to the image in our motion pictures, television broadcasts, and so forth. Now, one book that I recommend very highly in this regard is one that we sold for quite a while until we ran out of it. The book is by Patrick J. Buchanan, and it's entitled Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War. In this book, Patrick Buchanan lays out, I think, in his very persuasively and convincingly to any open-minded person, that in fact Hitler's aims were rather modest, certainly much more modest than American propaganda, television, and motion pictures portray. In fact, Pat Buchanan wrote an essay in keeping with the theme of his book entitled Did Hitler Want War? And lays out evidence which people can and should really check on their own to show that in 1939, when war broke out in Europe, Hitler's aims were very precise and very limited. It's true, of course, that Germany attacked Poland in September 1939, but it did so over issues of dispute with Poland that were very understandable, and the war came about in large measure, as Buchanan and many other historians have pointed out, because Poland absolutely refused to negotiate, to bend, to compromise on issues involving the rights of the German minority in Poland, and especially in the city of Danzig, which was a German city at the time, because Poland was fortified by a blank check treaty of support and pledge of support by Britain to go to war against Germany and therefore not to negotiate, not to compromise on these issues, which by any objective standard were entirely reasonable requests or demands by the German government at the time. But the image of World War II as the good war goes beyond, of course, far beyond just the outbreak of the war in 1939. The American media and American motion pictures give the impression that the war, as it expanded between Germany and then involving France and Britain, was because Hitler was bent on trying to subdue and conquer those two countries. But many Americans do not realize, because they don't get this from the American motion pictures and our books and so forth, but it was Britain and France that declared war on Germany in September 1939, not the other way around. In fact, the evidence is really absolutely clear that Hitler wanted very much to avoid any kind of war or conflict or military dispute, especially with Britain and France. The one country that Hitler over and over sought to try to make an alliance with was Britain. But it was Britain that declared war on Germany in 1939 on the pretext that Germany had violated Polish sovereignty and Polish independence. Well, the hypocrisy and the emptiness of this claim by Britain is shown by the fact that after 6 years of war, at the end of 1945, after the end of fighting in Europe, Poland was still not independent and sovereign. It was occupied by the Soviet Union, which installed its own government in Poland against the wishes of the Polish people, and also grabbed a large portion of Polish territory in what is now Belarus and Ukraine and made it part of the Soviet Union. And also, again, in violation of pledges made by the Allies during the war, added to Polish territory large sections of German lands, which had been German for centuries. But more to the point, World War II was not a conflict between good guys and bad guys, because America's two most important allies in World War II were countries that by no stretch of the imagination can be called supporters of freedom and democracy in the way that most Americans understand the word. America's most important military ally in World War II was the Soviet Union. By any objective standard, the Soviet government was the most tyrannical and oppressive regime in the world at the time. And the second most important American ally during World War II was the British Empire. No country in history has held as many people in subjugation against their will as did Britain during the 1930s and during World War II, when it controlled all of what is now India, all of what is now Pakistan, all of what is now Bangladesh, a very large section of Africa, and much of Southeast Asia, including what is now Malaysia and other areas in that part of the world. But so that the claim that World War II was a conflict between the good guys and bad guys is not only simplistic, it's a gross perversion, a distortion of the historical reality. Now, with regard to virtually every other conflict America has been involved in, it's been possible to speak with some objectivity, with some truthfulness, with the passage of time about the real nature and the real story about America's military role, whether it's the American Civil War, Spanish-American War, and First World War, and so forth. But speaking frankly and truthfully about World War II is particularly difficult because the Hitler government and the Hitler regime, of course, was vehemently, strongly anti-Jewish. And in our country, a look at world history, a look at history today in the world, without taking into account the Jewish angle is virtually impossible. And because the Hitler government was so staunchly and vehemently anti-Jewish, it's impossible for many Americans and certainly in American media to talk about the Hitler government and Third Reich Germany and World War II in anything like an objective, dispassionate way. Now, one of the remarkable features of the Barack Obama administration is not how much things have changed, despite the hopes and expectations and even the fears of many Americans. What's remarkable is how little things have changed in American life and American policy with the presidency of Barack Obama compared to the previous administration of George W. Bush. And I'm speaking especially in terms of foreign policy and foreign affairs. Now, when Barack Obama was campaigning for the White House, he made pledges about America's involvement in overseas conflicts that, in fact, during his administration, he's violated. And the most recent example of that is his decision to send American military into the conflict in Libya entirely on his own authority. He had no mandate or authorization from the Congress to send the U.S. military into the conflict in Libya. There was no national debate, no national cry for U.S. involvement in that conflict. But he got the United States involved in this conflict, albeit in a limited way, at least so far. Contrary, and in violation of pledges he had made when he was running for president about how the United States should not be involved in military conflict unless there was a really pressing reason or a pressing necessity to do so. Well, even more than that, contrary also to the expectation and hopes of many Americans, Barack Obama has actually expanded the U.S. involvement in the Afghanistan conflict. He's increased the number of troops in the Afghanistan war. Now, many people are still willing to give Barack Obama a break or a pass on that because they're still hoping or expecting that he will make everything right in the long run. In fact, the level of expectation about Barack Obama is so great that not long after he was president, he was awarded a Nobel Prize for Peace, not on the basis of anything he had actually done as president, but entirely on the basis of hopes or expectations, of wishful thinking about what he would do as president of the United States. But the remarkable thing, again, is not that Barack Obama has changed things so radically as commentators like Rush Limbaugh suggest day after day, week after week on their broadcast, the remarkable thing is how little things have changed. A very good article came out recently on this subject, written by a professor at the Boston University named Andrew Bakovich. His article, entitled Why Military Spending Remains Untouchable, is a very insightful article that goes into this question of why is it that even after the end of the Cold War, when Americans understandably expected and hoped that there would be a dismantling of this enormous U.S. military presence in the world, but instead the U.S. military has grown, has gotten larger with the passage of time, so that today the U.S. military, both in absolute and in relative terms, is greater, larger than it ever has been in American history. Now, Bakovich in this article summarizes the immensity, the enormity of the American military in one paragraph where he says, like concentric security barriers arrayed around the Pentagon, these four factors, and he names them, institutional self-interest, strategic inertia, cultural dissonance, and misremembered history, these four factors, insulate the military budget from serious scrutiny. For advocates of a militarized approach to policy, they provide invaluable assets to be defended at all costs. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about these four points he mentions in this article, which is an insightful and useful one. But first, I want to just point out the amazing feature, the amazing fact that when George W. Bush was president, there was a fairly large and active anti-war movement in this country. Large numbers, thousands and thousands of people took to the streets to protest George W. Bush's involvement, sending of American troops to Iraq and to Afghanistan. But after he was elected, this anti-war movement basically vanished. It disappeared. Now, in that regard, it's interesting that a survey was carried out recently by researchers at the University of Michigan and Indiana University that established pretty convincingly that the so-called anti-war movement that was in place and on the streets and active during the George W. Bush administration was essentially fake. It was phony. The motive of many of those people in that so-called anti-war movement was not really to oppose war. It was really opposing Republican wars. Not war in general, not the vast military-industrial complex, but the wars of the George W. Bush administration. One article that was recently was written on that subject makes this point. It's written by a man named Bernie DeGroat. He writes, since 2003, the anti-war movement in the United States has had much to protest, with Americans fighting in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Libya. But the movement, which has dropped off sharply the past 2 years, may be more anti-Republican than anti-war. He cites the study of this researcher at the University of Michigan and another researcher at Indiana University. The anti-war movement should have been furious at Obama's betrayal and reinvigorated its protest activity. Instead, attendance at anti-war rallies declined precipitously, and financial resources available to the movement have dissipated. The election of Obama appeared to be a demobilizing force on the anti-war movement, even in the face of his pro-war decisions. Another writer, a man named Glenn Ford, makes the point, in other words, much of the anti-war movement was phony, a cynical gathering of partisan Democrats who were really never all that concerned for the victims of U.S. imperial warfare or for the huge dislocations that the national security state places on the U.S. economy. No, They just wanted their guy, the Democrat, to win. Once Obama was safely in the White House, the anti-war movement was all but dismantled, having served its partisan political purpose. For the phony anti-warrior, imperialism with a democratic face is just fine. And this underscores a basic problem with the American political system. That is, Republican leaders and Democratic leaders put their own partisan interests ahead of principle and ahead of the authentic interests of the American people and of the interests of humanity. Time and again, Republicans will give a green light to policies carried out by a Republican administration that they condemn when carried out by a Democratic leader. And by the same token, Democratic leaders will approve of policies by a Democratic president or a Democratic administration that they condemn when carried out by a Republican administration. This kind of partisanship is disgusting to millions of Americans who see through this game. And that's one of the reasons that this has contributed tremendously to a rising level of cynicism by the American public and loss of faith in the leadership of both the Republican and Democratic Party. And this has been contributed to immensely by the dashed hopes and dashed expectations of the Barack Obama administration, which so many Americans had invested such hope and expectation. Again, back to this article by Andrew Bakovich. He stresses that there is such an entrenched interest in maintaining this military-industrial complex. So many businesses involved, so many people benefiting from it, that it stays in place. And another factor is the fear of politicians to be considered betraying our boys or not supporting the troops if they urge a reduction in the tremendous U.S. military presence. And then finally, Bakovich talks about a very important factor, and that is the distortion of history in our society, particularly about World War II. He points out that American politics once had a lively anti-interventionist tradition, but above all, the mythology about World War II has contributed to upholding this military-industrial complex. And unless and until Americans can have a more realistic and truthful understanding of World War II, this process will continue, and America will continue to squander hundreds of billions of dollars every year in this vast military, which is not useful. Well, that concludes this broadcast, and I hope you'll join me next time for the next broadcast of the Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.